It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a look at the race for mayor in Wisconsin's largest city.
First, the Overture Playhouse Gallery in Madison is currently showing an exhibit by the Fresh Perspective Art Collective, a group of black male artists with members from all parts of Wisconsin who stage art shows across the state.
Joining us to talk about the collective and the exhibit is a member of the leadership team and the curator for the Overture exhibit, Willie Lamar. Willie, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Well, tell us about how this art collective got started initially.
It initially started in 2014. It was a bunch of young artists collaborating, basically, on trying to put their artwork out in galleries. And from there, pretty much we just kind of formed a bond and just really just started kind of trying to figure out a way to showcase our artwork, because there's no real gallery that really showcases a lot of African-American artwork.
Can you tell us can you just tell us a little bit about the range of the artists that are involved? Who are these different artists?
They're ranging from sculptures to oil paintings to acrylic to photography. Some quilts, a nice little range of artists.
As you said, you've got these artists, they're from all over the state, varied backgrounds, various mediums. How does that influence the kind of shows that you put on?
Well, a lot of it is just, we sit down, we have, usually we try to have meetings every 3 months, and have the guys meet up, and we just kind of talk about where we would like to have the shows and try to come up with a game plan of basically showcasing our artwork.
Now, I've read that you say that your mission is to counter negative stereotypes against African-American men. How does that play out when you go to see one of these exhibits?
Well, it gives people a chance to interact with the artists and really hear their story and understand the reason why they came up with their art piece, and they can have a nice dialogue and get a real good understanding of that artist. And sometimes I don't think a lot of people really get a chance to actually talk with the artist. You see a lot of artwork on at shows, but you don't really see the artists themselves. And to really have that interaction with the artist is quite unique.
How does that change things?
Well, I think it changes in retrospect to their story and understanding that they're not out here just trying to, a lot of these artists aren't just out here just kind of like shooting or trying to do harmful things. They're really trying to do some positive things. And there are some artists who have done some things, and they're trying to change their ways. And it gives them a little bit of a platform to rehabilitate, but to showcase their talents in different ways.
We're talking right now with Willie Lamar, member of the Fresh Perspective Art Collective and curator for the exhibit at the Overture Playhouse Gallery. That exhibit is on display through Sunday, February 28th. And I wonder, Willie, if you could describe a piece or two from the collection for us.
Yes, there's a piece there by Brando Clemens, and basically his piece is with Kanye West, and it has Kanye West on there, and then it has pictures of stars. Inside of the stars, there are pictures of people in the basically in the neighborhood and around the country, and who are doing positive things in their community or in Wisconsin as well. So I was trying to showcase the positive aspect of African Americans. And then there's another piece by Odello, and he does basically storybooks, and he's telling stories through cultural I would say, what, culturally, more or less black, white, Chinese, Hispanic, as far as interacting with storybooks. And he showcases his illustration through storytelling, which is, you know, quite different. And I also have a piece myself as well, and because I do photography. So I do a lot of landscaping photography, and I try to do things in more or less in a panoramic format versus just a photo itself. So then that way you can kind of get a grasp of an area.
And we do have that piece by Odalo on the Central Time Facebook page, so that's there for people to check out if they're not able to make it to Madison for this exhibit. And speaking of where you can see this collective, where else do you typically have exhibits besides Madison?
Well, we're actually holding a show here in Milwaukee on the 5th and 6th, and that will be at the Leader Lux Moto. And we're going to be doing a show there for 2 days. And then we're going to be holding another show in Racine and Kenosha. So we're trying to hold shows in different parts of the state where people can kind of just see African-American artwork that they typically wouldn't see elsewhere.
And as you said, this might not be something your average person who takes in an art exhibit would see, a collection that's all African-American artists, all men. Does the group function together socially at all? Do you come together and support each other as artists, as people?
Yes. There's several artists who go to different galleries, and they'll let us know, and we go out and support them, come out and see where their artwork is, and just, you know, be real supportive, because I think it's very important that we show that we're united, even though we're not together, but yet we're still united, regardless of what they're doing. We want them to feel that support coming from us.
What kinds of things do people say to you after they've seen one of these exhibits?
Oh, they really love it. They think it was different. They like the talent. They would like to see us in other galleries. They would like for us to have other venues, or some people will ask if we can have, would we host like their business or company function, and we've done that as well. We've gone in and held company social events for them, and which was really nice.
Well, Willie, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it.
That was Willie Lamar, member of Fresh Perspective Art Collective and curator for the exhibit at the Overture Playhouse Gallery in Madison. That exhibit is on display through Sunday, February 28th.
Also, a two-day pop-up exhibit, as he mentions, opens in Milwaukee next Friday evening. You can check out the Fresh Perspective Art Collective Facebook page, and we've got a link, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page for more info and to see some of the art involved.
First, Milwaukee residents will head to the polls this spring, first in February for a primary race and again in April for the general election to choose a mayor. The race will pit incumbent Tom Barrett against some well-known challengers.
Joining us to discuss the race and the issues that will bring voters to the polls is Mary Spicuzza. She's a reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Mary, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you run down who are the candidates in this race for mayor of Wisconsin's largest city?
Sure. There's Mayor Tom Barrett, who is running for his fourth term in office. He's being challenged. He has three challengers. Two are longtime aldermen, Alderman Bob Donovan and Alderman Joe Davis. And then there's actually a political newcomer who is just 30 years old and has never run for public office or held public office before.
Well, let's run across the ideological spectrum here. Tom Barrett, not a stranger to people around Wisconsin, of course, longtime mayor there, former congressman, Democratic governor, or Democratic candidate for governor a couple times.
Right, how about, twice.
Twice, yeah. So can you run through the rest of the field, though?
Sure. So he obviously has the highest profile and is the only one who's run for statewide office. He's very well known, and he has won his he won his first election and then his two following re-elections by quite healthy margins. And he is facing two longtime veterans who have been around City Hall for quite a while and are quite known to the city of Milwaukee, not so much outstate, but certainly around here. And then the third political newcomer who really is just kind of new to the scene, and a lot of people don't know too much about him and are starting to hear about him now. But he, you know, Mayor Barrett is, most people say he's a nice guy. A lot of people like him. And I think all of his opponents are saying that about him, but they're also criticizing him, especially over public safety and the spike in homicides that Milwaukee experienced over the last year. Also, there's been a rash of car thefts and fatal crashes involving stolen cars. Also, economic development is something that comes up quite a bit. He's really led kind of a renaissance in downtown development, but a lot of his critics and his opponents are saying that they want to see the neighborhoods benefiting more from that economic development, and they want to see local people getting jobs. They want to see, I guess, kind of there's just been a lot of concern about disparity and poverty in the city, and they don't feel like the development downtown is spreading into those neighborhoods.
Well, and getting to the other candidates somewhere, Bob Donovan is a name that I think appears a lot in coverage of Milwaukee issues. He's often critical of policing and the way it's done in the city, a lot of other issues.
Right.
Would it be fair to characterize him as a more conservative challenger here?
That would be. And he has the endorsement of the Milwaukee Police Officers Union. Davis has the endorsement of the firefighters. You know, obviously both of those groups have clashed with Mayor Barrett over the years, especially over the residency requirements and whether they need to live in the city of Milwaukee. So those weren't terribly surprising of endorsements. But yes, I mean, Bob Donovan recently over plowing, over policing, I would say he rarely passes up on an opportunity to criticize Mayor Barrett on his policies.
Well, you started to get into the issues in this race, and for people around the state, something that's been front and center was last year's homicide total. This is something that got attention around the state, around the country, as part of a wider urban trend in some cities. Is this something that you see people really thinking about when it comes to a mayoral election over the next few months?
Yeah, I think that you know, if when you're seeing just day after day of reports of somebody being killed or shot, it you know, it obviously raises a lot of concerns. And Milwaukee is not the only city in the nation that had a spike in homicides last year, but it was one of a group that really experienced a pretty severe spike. And you know, some of them are domestic violence, but often, you know, there's gangs or drugs or random shootings, and it's I think it has a lot of people concerned.
And then another issue that, again, has been on the minds of people around the state is the Milwaukee Bucks Arena, whether it would be funded, how much funding it would get from the state to the county and, of course, the city. Is this something that you think the candidates will be sparring over, that voters are still wondering how exactly it's all going to play out?
I think so, although all of the candidates who were in office at the time, so aside from the man who's never held public office, all of them, the aldermen voted for the funding, and Mayor Barrett obviously supported it. And I think they will say, you know, in their minds, they're supporting economic development, and this new arena will bring jobs and spur more growth and really kind of be part of this downtown renaissance. You know, there are a lot of people who say that the owners of the Bucks are wealthy enough and they can pay for their own arena, and that the public shouldn't be subsidizing it with taxpayer dollars.
Talking to Mary Spicuzza from the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel, previewing the race for mayor in Milwaukee, a high profile, a big news or whatever happens for people around the state, a longtime incumbent there, Tom Barrett. So Tom Barrett has won previously by pretty big margins, as you mentioned earlier. What does the money look like in the race? It's hard to talk about any campaign race for anything these days without showing us the money. What are we seeing so far?
We are seeing that Tom Barrett has a lot of money. He has more than $800,000 in his campaign coffers for cash on hand. He is that is dramatically more than any of his opponents. Alderman Donovan, you know, obviously he's well known. He's also running for re-election to his seat as alder, which is a bit unusual to be running for two seats at once. And he's actually even put out flyers in his district saying, vote for me for both offices. He had about $27,000 cash on hand at the end of last year, and Joe Davis had actually a little bit less than that with about nearly $25,000. And James Matthew had more like $6,000. So it is not even close when you look at just the money.
And how does an urban election, a big city election like this, differ from, say, a statewide election or a congressional election? How does the retail politics of running for mayor work in a city like Milwaukee?
I think, you know, a lot of it, a lot of the candidates are getting out in public, doing public events, kind of trying to get FaceTime with voters. A lot of, there are groups who say, you know, elections shouldn't be about personality, they should be about issues, and we want people to be focused on the issues. However, this is not, you know, this isn't coming up during, this isn't like a presidential race turnout, and so I think that there are going to be people who just say, like, well, I like Mayor Barrett, he's a nice guy, I'll vote for him. And I think that there are some groups now who are trying to kind of raise people's awareness on what's going on with public safety, what's going on with education, what's going on with economic development. But I think personalities always come into play in these things.
Well, you mentioned low voter turnout, and these February primaries, spring general elections are well known for not having the kind of turnout the fall elections do. So can endorsements make a difference? You mentioned those police and fire union endorsements. Is that something that if you can motivate a small but significant portion of the population, it can help swing a race like this?
I think it can have an effect. I don't know about swinging a race. I think that, you know, I would be very surprised if I saw long lines and people not getting to vote because they have to wait too long. I think it's going to be, which is good for people who are voting. It'll be faster for them. But I don't really see people necessarily flooding to the polls just over an endorsement from one group or the other on this one.
Now, speaking of polls, there isn't the kind of intense polling that we'll see, certainly for the presidential election, even for, you know, a race for governor or U.S. Senate, as we'll have this fall. But is there a sense that, hey, people have elected Mayor Barrett in the past, they're likely to do so again?
I think so, especially when you look at the money, and he's obviously not just spending tons of money now heading into the primary, and so he will likely, once the primary is over, he will likely head into that spring election with probably a very good amount of money, pretty similar to what he has now, and so I think that he will be able to get his message out. I don't want to say that he will be elected or reelected by the margin that we've seen in previous elections, but I can't imagine that he's necessarily lying awake at night worried about whether he's going to be surpassed in campaign fundraising at this point.
At the state level, Governor Walker ran for president. His popularity, his approval in the state took a hit, apparently because of that run, taking him out of the state. Tom Barrett ran for governor twice. Was there ever any sense that that hurt him in the eyes of Milwaukeeans?
I think there were some people who felt like he had just gotten reelected as mayor and then turned around and was running for governor in the recall, and that there were some people who were thinking, like, well, do you really want to be mayor? But I don't think that we've seen anything to show that his popularity has taken a hit the way that Governor Walker's popularity has taken a hit in the state. And, you know, obviously there's more polling coming from Marquette and other areas, but I would be very, very surprised if Mayor Barrett's approval ratings were anywhere as low as Governor Walker's at this point.
Tom Barrett has had a fairly long run as mayor. He could add another term on. Is that putting him in the record books yet in Milwaukee, or have we seen longer serving mayors there?
Yeah, no, I think Mayor Myers still has him beat on that one, and it would probably take him a while to get there, and he might want to think about retiring before he gets that close. But, you know, I guess we'll have to wait and see how long he wants to keep trying to run.
Now, in a lot of smaller communities, maybe that run for mayor or city council or board of supervisors isn't the talk of the town, it isn't the big buzz. Is it in a city like Milwaukee? Are people excited about this is really the biggest race in the state, apart from the state Supreme Court. Is there a lot of buzz about this one in the city?
You know, I think we kind of expected it to heat up a little bit more after the holidays. And honestly, the other campaigns, while they've criticized him on the homicide rate or on public safety or more recently on snow plowing, we haven't seen we haven't seen extremely aggressive campaigns from the others in terms of laying out a platform of, if I'm elected mayor, this is what I would do to take on the homicide rate, or, you know, anything that kind of resembles some kind of very detailed platform. So presumably we'll see that in the weeks and months ahead, but it has been, I would say, it's not exactly jumped to the front of everybody's radar at this point.
Mary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I've been talking to Mary Spacuzza. She's a politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, giving us an overview there of the upcoming Milwaukee mayoral race. Earlier this week, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force released new guidelines on depression screening. They recommend all adults should be screened for depression as a routine part of health care. The new guidelines separately addresses pregnant women and new mothers to say they in particular would benefit from that kind of screening.
Now that so many people are being screened, there will probably be more people diagnosed with depression. So we're talking to an expert about treatment options for depression now. Dr. Steve Garlow joins us. He's a professor of psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Garlow, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So we mentioned these new guidelines. Can you tell us a little bit more about what they are? What are they?
The U.S. Preventative Services Task Force is a part of the health quality organization in the government, and they have done a very large study, a very thoughtful assessment of all potential guidelines around depression, and they have very strongly recommended that everybody in the setting of their delivery of health care get screened for the presence of depression and then also referred for appropriate treatment. And I think this is a major move forward in terms of recognizing depression as a chronic illness, very similar to the approach taken to things like hypertension, diabetes, and other kind of chronic illnesses like that.
Do you have a sense about why this panel made this move to step up screenings for depression?
Well, this is their third iteration of reviewing the literature, developing guidelines, and data has been accumulating over the last 10 years, the last 6 years. The last time they did this was 2009, on the utility of screening instruments, on then once the patient's identified on the benefits of treatment in terms of their medical and their mental health outcomes.
I want to take a look at how we define depression.
Sure.
To make sure we're all on the same page. What is the medical definition?
Yeah, a major depressive episode, a major depressive disorder, is a condition, it's a psychiatric illness, it's a pathological mood state. It impacts a number of different domains, the person's mood, their emotional state, their activity level, their sleep patterns, their energy levels, their interest in food, their appetitive behaviors, as well as chronic thoughts of death and risk for suicide. So it's not just having a bad day. It's not just being upset about something. It is a chronic and persisting pathological mood state. To make a diagnosis of depression, a person has to have these symptoms for 2 weeks or more, and they have to be significant in that they impact and impair the person's activities of daily living, cause them to seek treatment for it.
Right, and as you said, I mean, these can be shifting changes in a person. How do we know that we're catching someone when they are experiencing it? What would the guidelines have to do to accomplish that?
Well, so what the guidelines are recommending is that everybody, that when people are at their health care, at their doctor's office, they get a screening instrument. The one that's very commonly used for adults is something called the PHQ-9, the Patient Healthcare Questionnaire 9, and it asks the 9 cardinal symptoms of depression, and then it's been rated so that if a person scores a 15, they have an 85% likelihood of having a moderately severe depressive episode. The recommendations, though, don't rely on just the screening instrument. So once the person's been identified via the screening instrument, they should be referred to somebody, to a knowledgeable professional who can then do a further clinical assessment of their condition to further establish whether they have a diagnosis of depression or not.
We're talking right now to Dr. Steve Garlow from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, talking about treatment options for people with depression in light of new depression screening guidelines from a federal task force that were released earlier this week. And Dr. Garlow, the screening guidelines, they also focus a lot of attention on pregnant women and also new mothers. Why those groups of people?
Well, depression during pregnancy and depression during the postpartum period can be a very significant problem for both the mother and the child and the family unit. Mothers who are depressed are less focused on, less able to engage their child in the very essential early moments of life when the formative mother-child bond is being made. This could impact the child's developmental trajectory. Women who are depressed while they're pregnant can oftentimes not take as good care of themselves, not have as good nutrition, not have as good prenatal behaviors and activities, be as diligent in the sort of things that lead to better pregnancy outcomes. And it's been kind of a chronically under-recognized and under-focused group of patients.
And we know that postpartum depression, that's gotten a fair bit of attention over the last decade or so, but less so for depression that might be developing while a mother is still pregnant.
Right.
Why do we need to focus attention there?
Well, women who are pregnant and who have depression, they have lower birth weight babies. They're being depressed puts a tremendous stress burden on the mother, which in turn puts a stress burden on the developing child. It's not an insignificant thing for a woman to be depressed in terms of the stress on her and then the stress that's transmitted to the child. And as a result of that, then that's going to impact the potential birth outcome. And so identifying that woman and making the right interventions can have a positive outcome on the pregnancy, and then after the pregnancy on the development of the family unit, the mother-child relationship.
Can you tell us a little bit more about how depression screening works, how big a deal it might be for physicians to start adding this to the routine?
Well, so one of the things that the U.S., the Preventative Task Force, they emphasize over and over and over again in the document they released is it's screening in the setting of adequate resources to follow through with that patient. So just using some kind of a screening tool like the PHQ-9, the Edinburgh postpartum depression screening tools, what they recommend for postpartum women, it's not enough to just screen and identify those people. There has to be people within the care system that can then pick up on that patient, further assess their clinical state, whether they do in fact have a depressive disorder, whether they do in fact need treatment, what treatment they're going to need. So it's not enough to just hand the person a piece of paper with 9 questions on it and get a score and say, okay, well, you're depressed. It's having the full system of care that comes with with initially identifying the patient, and this is even more so, I think, with the pregnant women and the postpartum women. These are women in a vulnerable state. It's not just them; it's them and the child who are the focus of treatment. So, having knowledgeable providers who can act on more. The screening is just that's the first step that identifies the person, and then having the whole system of care. The model is now for diabetes and blood pressure, this sort of comprehensive model identifying the person and then having multiple layers of treatment providers managing the patient long term. That's the same model that's being proposed for depression, and I think it's a major step forward in terms of public health, public mental health in this country.
Do you think those systems are in place right now? I mean, look at here in Wisconsin, we have shortages of mental health care and lots of pockets of rural Wisconsin. So if you've got so many more people being screened, how do you make sure? That seems like the harder stuff, making sure the systems are there, the care is there.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I mean, that's reading through the guidelines, they say over and over again, with an adequate resource system, they make this point, it's not enough just to identify the person with the screening tool. It's to have the mechanisms, to have the comprehensive care, the cooperative model of care, to have all those providers in place. These are issues of workforce development. development. These are issues of access. These are issues of who's going to pay. I mean, it's a big question that you ask, and the answer for which is larger than just saying, well, we need to screen everybody.
We're talking with Dr. Steve Garlow right now from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We're talking about treatment options for people with depression in light of new depression screening guidelines from a federal task force released earlier this week. And coming up, we'll talk more about what that treatment could look like.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has depression touched your life, your family? Have you or someone close to you suffered from depression? What questions do you have about what's out there in the world of depression treatment? What do you think of this idea of screening for everyone? Do we have the resources out there? And if you work in the healthcare professions, what do you think of this idea? As a doctor, as a nurse, would you want to do these screenings for your patients? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion now about treatment options for depression with Dr. Steve Garlow from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about treatment for depression? Have you or someone close to you experienced depression? And were you able, if so, to find the help, the treatment you needed? Is there access to these services out there? And what do you think of this idea of screening patients, whether you're a patient or a healthcare provider yourself? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's talk a little bit about treatment now. What kinds of options might be in place, and who could administer them? Would it be the primary care physician, or would it be somebody else?
Yeah, certainly there are multiple options for treating depression. It is a treatable disorder, as treatable as other chronic illnesses, and treating it improves outcomes, both in terms of the person's mental status, but as well as their medical condition as well. So treating depression in a person who's got chronic medical illnesses makes it so the patient's better able to manage those chronic medical illnesses. So treating depression, it helps the person not just feel emotionally better, but helps manage their medical conditions as well. So that there are real positive reasons to do this. The options are antidepressants, of which there's a large number now that are safe and efficacious. There is no question that antidepressants work. So that would be under the supervision of a physician or a nurse practitioner or physician's assistant who is trained and knowledgeable in depression and in use of antidepressants. It could be with a psychiatrist. And there are a number of psychotherapies that are also very well known to be efficacious in treating depression, a therapy called cognitive behavioral therapy, it's referred to by CBT as the acronym, has been shown repeatedly to be beneficial and efficacious in treating depression. That's the treatment that's actually recommended in the treatment guidelines, in the new guidelines for pregnant women, because it's a non-pharmacological intervention. Having good CBT requires having good, well-trained CBT therapists available to those patients. Having people who are knowledgeable in use of antidepressants requires having well-trained, knowledgeable individuals who are available to see those patients. But treatment is available, and treatment does help, and it does work.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Sigourney on the line from Green Bay. Hi, Sigourney.
Hi there.
What was your story?
Well, I've had depression since I was very young. I was diagnosed around the age of 16, and personally, I wish that there were more systems in place for me to have been diagnosed earlier. I feel like I would have been very much helped throughout my childhood if we'd kind of known what the issue was. And been able to see some of the red flags that were put up. I find that, multiple areas of care are very much needed in treating my depression, such as counseling and then medicine. And I get it from different branches. And so it's important to have that approach of multiple areas of resource to be able to treat it properly.
And do you think that this new screening tool, upping the screening, do you think that would have helped you earlier on?
I definitely think it would have helped. Like I said, I wish that I had those kind of tools growing up, that I might have been able to take hold of it earlier and, maybe quit some of the struggles that I had going through high school with depression.
And Dr. Barlow, is this kind of the dream that we do get to these people earlier and get them the help that they need a lot earlier than they might have gotten otherwise?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question that the longer a person has depression untreated, the worse their condition can become, the worse their life is, the worse their medical conditions can become, the more difficult to treat the depressive disorder becomes. So identifying people at the earliest point when they do have, clearly have, identifiable, diagnosable depression, and then treating it effectively is clearly the best approach and could really help people downstream before the disease becomes more chronic and has greater impact on people's lives and functionality and ability to go to work or complete school, participate in their families. So that's one of the real, important aspects of this is identifying the people early and getting them appropriate treatment early as well.
We're talking to the UW-Madison's Dr. Steve Garlow, talking about new depression screening guidelines and the treatment that might be available there. And we'll go next to Brooke. Brooke joins us in Madison. Hi there.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure. What did you want to add?
I just love this discussion. And coming from somebody who was diagnosed with depression in middle school, I love the idea of dealing with different therapies when you're young, because I think that manifests into a much bigger problem as an adult. Like you said, holding a job, finishing college, it's very hard to retrain yourself, you know, in your 20s, how to deal with something that you've been struggling with for years, especially with, you know, health insurance, and you might not have that offered through your employer. And I really don't like to rely on medication. The screenings are important early on. It gets much harder as an adult to hold a full-time job and finish school and all of that stuff.
Brooke, thank you so much. Appreciate that call. And another caller there, Dr. Garlow, talking about catching this early, treating it early, and not letting it sort of boomerang throughout the rest of a person's life early on.
Yep.
And we haven't really, the guidelines don't make specific reference to adolescents, to children, but I assume that that will be a big focus here, too.
Yeah, there's a separate task force that's focusing on that. These guidelines are 18 and above, and they specifically focus on adult, pregnant, and postpartum, and then older adults, and there'll be a separate set of recommendations around approaches to depression in children and adolescents. That's a nuanced discussion. There are sort of more factors involved. So the current guidelines do not address adolescent and childhood onset. But I'd like to respond to one of the things that this last caller said. In a systematic way, now that if these guidelines become sort of the practice and the norm, she mentioned insurance, and this is, I think we cannot bring this type of approach forward without also having it connected to the payer resources that are going to support the treatment. So moving mental illness, moving treatment for depression onto equal footing as in terms of a third-party payer, in terms of an insurance structure, as other chronic diseases are, as is diabetes, as is hypertension. I think to bring these screening guidelines and recommendations forward, which are really quite well thought out, it has to come with an equal commitment in terms of an ability of the resources to support it.
Dr. Garlow, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Now, it's Dr. Steve Garlow, professor of psychiatry at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us to talk about new guidelines for depression screening.